Welcome back to the London Futurist podcast. Our guest today is the scientist and science fiction author David Brin, whose writings have won the Hugo, Locus, Campbell, and Nebula awards. His style is sometimes called hard science fiction. This means his narratives feature scientific or technological change that is plausible rather than purely magical. The scenarios he creates are thought-provoking as well as entertaining. His writing inspires readers but also challenges them with important questions not just about the future but also about the present. Perhaps his most famous non-fiction work is his book The Transparent Society: Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? First published in 1998. But with each passing year, it seems that the questions and solutions raised in that book are becoming ever more pressing. For example, one aspect has been called Brin's corollary to Moore's Law. Every year, the cameras will get smaller, cheaper, more numerous, and more mobile. David also frequently writes online about topics such as space exploration, attempts to contact aliens, homeland security, the influence of science fiction on society and culture, the future of democracy, and much more besides. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, David, and Callum, nice to see you as well. It's nice to see anybody at my age. And the year 2023, which was featured in so many past dystopias, when you look around yourself, remember, things aren't as bad as we were warned they'd be.
Is that our motto for the day? We're still here.
It could be worse.
It could be worse.
David, what would you want our listeners to know about you that was omitted from that brief introduction?
I'm thought of as a science fiction author because that's the thing that society has decided I do best. It's helped pay for a nice home for myself and my family. But in all honest appreciation, I'm more of a dilettante. I have my PhD in astrophysics. I work with NASA's Innovative and Advanced Concepts program. But I poke at things. You know, I have patents that I've never really tried hard to develop. I have a tendency to follow the next shiny thing. So if I wander away from the podcast, it's because a flying saucer or a robot or mutant has shown up at my door.
Well, in seriousness, what goes through your mind when you hear yet another report about a perceived flying saucer or a UFO that can't be explained by ordinary explanations?
Well, you mentioned Brin's corollary to Moore's Law, that the cameras get more numerous, more mobile, cheaper every single year. Well, there are estimated to be somewhere on the order of 50 million more cameras active on the Earth's surface today than there were in the 1950s, the heyday of photographing so-called flying saucers. That's about 50 million more active cameras. So how come the UFOs keep getting blurrier and blurrier and blurrier? I have a short story about that, about the possibility that they're like elves, because if you look at the purported UFO behavior, it's exactly the same as the elves used to do back when our frontier was the firelight of the local village, and they were surrounded by a vast universe of the forest. Then the elves came in from the forest and did probes and stole children and all the things that UFOs purportedly are doing now. Our firelight fills the globe, and our forest, dark forest, is beyond the earth. The behavior is the same, which implies that it's something that erupts out of human nature, human imagination. Now, mind you, I've been involved in SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, for about 45 years. No one has thought about the alien from a science fictional perspective, from a fantasy perspective, from a scientific exploratory perspective more than I have. And the thing that bums me out about all the UFO stuff is how dull and unimaginative their portrayal of the alien is. It's just dumb stuff. In my opinion, for instance, in my novel Existence, I think that the form of alien encounter that we're most likely to have is when we get out there into the asteroid belt, we might find either active or likely extinct mechanical probes sent between the stars to observe the solar system or explorers or whatever. So I think some form of contact is possible. But I have an essay about these UAP, unexplained aerial phenomena, that I'll give you to put in the chat below. It's basically most of what we're seeing now from the naval pilots' recordings and things like that are much more easily explicable by experiments being performed by humans. And I'm not talking about hyperdrive, I'm not talking about anti-gravity. I'm talking about just simply creating glowing phenomena in the atmosphere. You give me $10 million in a year, and I will recreate these glowing tic-tac things zipping around. We need to grow up a little bit.
If I had a tin hat on, which I don't, I would say that, well, the aliens have seen all our 50 million extra cameras and they're just running around faster so that our pictures are the same. Obviously, that's all complete nonsense. I think you have a theory, don't you, about why there's been a recurrence of UFO fascination. Isn't it something to do with the military trying to camouflage some things that they're doing?
No, actually, the opposite. Well, yes, of course, the military is camouflaging things they're doing. This is one of the reasons when I consult with the military and the intelligence agencies, I refuse a security clearance, because I can provide them with thought experiments. I can provide them with what-if scenarios without holding back. And I can provide you with things because I know no real secrets, but my speculations are generally very often very good. And I believe that a lot of these phenomena are cat lasers. In other words, some research institution, probably our own, is shining converging beam lasers into the atmosphere, causing plasma dots. And you can move those around faster than Einstein.
Is that new? Presumably they weren't doing that 50 years ago when the first wave of UFO...
Not 50 years ago, but they probably have been doing it for 15, 20 years, but with greater sophistication and skill. And the second reason why we're getting more UFO reports from the military is that some of our military officers at the very top had an epiphany and they realized that their previous behavior towards reports was simply immature and counterproductive. You don't punish pilots for reporting what they see. Excuse me, duh. You reward reports because reports from skilled people, even if the report means they need to take a vacation for a week or two.
Actually, especially if it means that if they're flying several billion pounds worth of aircraft.
Yes. It's one of those epiphanies that was a long time coming. That's part of the reason why there have been so many reports that at least the U.S. federal government is suddenly saying, let's hold hearings, let's go ahead and analyze everything. Well, the paranoid thing to say is that it's just a new layer of cover-up, more sophisticated than before. Or else, it's just one more sign that the military officer corps is not completely grown up, but it has a lot of grown-ups in it. At least the ones I've met.
You talk about the possibility of discovering things in the asteroid belt when we eventually go there. Things that are possibly remnants of extraterrestrial civilizations. What's the chance that when Elon Musk goes to Mars, that he will find, or people with him will discover, on Mars some signs of life? Is this something that excites you?
Well, I think we are doing Mars. The rovers, these fantastic, incredible laboratories that show that human beings are just amazingly skilled. The fact that our citizens don't get pleasure from knowing how spectacular their civilization is to have done these things is depressing to me. I don't expect Elon to get to Mars right away. He's talking about creating, and he's doing a good job of creating rockets that are an order of magnitude more capable so we can do such things. But Mars has weather. Mars has weathering of the dust. The moon, this Artemis program, I'm notorious for thinking it's a terrible mistake. The asteroids are where all the wealth is. Exposed minerals, metals, pure metals, ice that can be harvested robotically. I think the moon should be left to the kiddies. It's a tourist sandbox. We went there 50 years ago, had our rite of passage. Today we are grown-ups. Or a bar moonzvah, so to speak. I don't think we should interfere with the right of others to have their flag-raising moments on a plane of poison, useless dust. Anybody who talks about lunar resources, other than some ice at the poles, doesn't know what they're talking about at all.
But isn't the moon helpful just because it's outside the Earth's gravity well? Isn't that its main use?
It is in one sense, in that we can practice landings in vacuum. Before we go to Mars, we'll probably do some dry runs on the moon. Over the long run, there will be lunar cities. I'm fine with that. With NASA's Innovative and Advanced Concepts program, NIAC, we fund projects to develop robotic techniques of using the moon. The lava tubes that appear to be down there might offer a sheltered place for habitats. But I see no reason why the United States and Japan and the EU should go there with manned missions. Robotic, yes, exploration, technology, keep ahead, stay ahead of our rivals. We're the ones who are capable of going to the asteroids. Japan, with ESA's help and NASA, have already been doing asteroid missions. And that's where all the wealth is. Why should we do what all the kiddies want to do?
So you and Peter Diamandis are going to be strip mining the asteroids in the next decade or so?
There are billions and billions and billions of them. I'm more concerned that when we develop that capability, it be properly supervised so that nobody decides to steer one in the wrong direction. But there's all varieties out there, and I think that that's how we would get our children to be wealthy. But to answer your original question, let's say you are an alien race that wants to keep track of the universe. Well, we've been doing a lot of radio searches, and the original idea that aliens would be beaming out these hugely expensive, prodigious tutorial beacons to teach all the newcomers how to live at peace and cure cancer. Well, that's been disproved. That is simply not the case. My friend, the late Frank Drake, hoped for that, and it didn't happen. We have to hope the very opposite isn't the case, and that's what was portrayed by Liu Cixin in his Hugo-winning trilogy, The Three-Body Problem, which was highly paranoid and extremely good science fiction. Somewhere in between is what I portray in my novel Existence, where what really makes sense for aliens to do, if they live in a fairly lonely universe, is to send out probes. And these probes are initially very expensive, but when they get to a new solar system, each probe makes a dozen copies of itself, refuels all of those babies, and sends them onto new solar systems while it settles down to watch that solar system and keep an eye on what's going on for maybe millions of years. Economically, over millions of years, that's the system that makes sense. Now, Arthur Clarke wrote about that possibility in his short story, The Sentinel, in which a monolith is buried on the moon, and when humans dig it up and expose it to sunshine, it tells the universe, hey, the creatures on this planet have grown up enough to do space flight. That led, of course, to 2001, A Space Odyssey. Well, we're pretty sure there's no such thing on the moon. There are some moonlets, little tiny moon-like objects that orbit the Earth that we've recently discovered. The Chinese are planning probes to look at those. Those might be good places to establish such a thing. But as I portray in my novel Existence, if you hide such an observing station in the asteroid belt, it's difficult to find. So that's a possibility.
But my trouble with these sorts of ideas that there are intelligent civilizations around and they have been sending probes out and they're just kind of keeping fairly low profile is if there's a few of them, then there's probably lots and lots. If it's easy enough to get intelligent life in this universe, then there's probably a ton of it, just dozens and dozens and dozens all over the place. And surely one of them would have been scatty enough or brazen enough or egocentric enough to blurt out pi in a way that was unmistakable across the universe, which you could do quite easily by surrounding a big star with some objects and then periodically occluding and unoccluding it. So you blat out pi at the speed of light, and it's visible to everybody. We're fairly confident, we haven't seen everything yet, but we're reasonably confident that's not happening. So it makes me think that we really are actually alone.
Well, the scenario you mentioned, we haven't studied enough to be able to really tell, except for the nearest 100 light years or so. The European Gaia mission is one of the greatest things anybody ever launched into space, because it is measuring the exact positions and other traits of 10 million or more objects out there, really complementing the American TESS and Kepler space probes, which have discovered planets. And of course, planets we now know are highly plentiful out there. Maybe 1 in 20 stable stars out there has an Earth-like planet, probably in the so-called Goldilocks zone, where water might be on the surface. But what we now realize is there are at least 6 and possibly as many as 12 ice-roofed ocean worlds in our solar system, like Europa and Enceladus. We now are pretty sure Ganymede and Callisto, Pluto, for heaven's sake, Titan, and even Ceres, perhaps. That means that almost any star that you see out there might be an abode of some kind of life. So my calculation of the Drake equation, the Fermi paradox, I believe that the most likely explanation is us. That our level of intelligence is probably very rare, and there are reasons to believe that. Some of my science fiction, for example, Startide Rising, Uplift War, the Uplift Trilogy, these are about humanity giving that final boost of intelligence to dolphins and apes, and then finding out in the galaxy that that's what everybody else has been doing. The notion that we might have evolved intelligence by accident, by evolution, is considered to be heresy.
I thoroughly enjoyed Startide Rising. I wasn't quite sure, though, why you wanted dolphins to be flying spaceships. Why was that?
Oh, because the notion is that they are natural pilots, besides which everybody loves a dolphin.
Yeah, everybody loves a dolphin.
You have to go with people's hates, but secondarily with their loves in science fiction.
Yeah.
If you take a look at every year, there are news reports and articles about this or that animal species that appears to be smarter than we thought they were. Crows and ravens use tools and even make tools. They're very clever. They figure out things. Parrots, sea lions, elephants for sure.
Octopodes.
Well, octopodes are very, very interesting. They can solve some problems too. Always these articles gush with exactly the wrong conclusion, that it means that humans aren't so special, because humility is chic. To say we're not so special is chic because, for one thing, it helps us to maybe decide to manage the planet better. But actually, if you look at these lists of at least 24 species on this planet who have roughly the same semantic ability, just a little below chimps and dolphins, the actual conclusion is the diametric opposite. It appears to be that nature and Darwin allow and even encouraged a certain level of intelligence up to which it's easy and beyond which is impossible. A glass ceiling. Velociraptors might have had that level of intelligence too. But it didn't help them. They didn't have a space program. They didn't have, you know, a program like the B612 Foundation that I'm on the board of directors to discover where all the asteroids are that might hit us.
You've got to tame fire. That's the glass ceiling, isn't it? You've got to get through fire.
Well, The Quest for Fire is both an absurd and absolutely gorgeous movie. I adore it. But the lesson from discovering all these pre-sapient species on Earth is diametrically the opposite. It's that something really, really special happened with us. And it didn't happen just marginally, arithmetically. It happened geometrically, exponentially. And in my novel Existence, I talk about that, how it's possible that maybe 80,000 years ago, our ancestors stumbled into a biological ability to reprogram our software. And that ever since then, we've had successive operating system upgrades through language that did not require changes in the hardware. In Existence, I talk about how 40,000 years ago, our tool sets increased by a factor of four, suddenly within just a few hundred years, and coincidentally, Neanderthals disappeared. When we first tried to get out of Africa 150,000 years ago, we got our asses kicked back into Africa. But when we came back out 50,000 years ago, everything had changed. When you write science fiction, you get to speculate. Yes, sure, that's what's called hard science fiction. But then again, do you call hard science fiction my novel Kiln People, where every day you can bake cheap clay copies of yourself in a home oven or kiln and send them out into the world? I mean, that's... I don't know if I'd call...
You mentioned hard science fiction. I think one of the hard things about science fiction is now that we know how good AI is and it's going to be in the next few decades, it's very hard to write about the medium-term future. Because let's say sometime during this century, almost certainly, we'll have artificial general intelligence, then we'll have superintelligence. And then writing about a world in which there is superintelligence is really hard because it's basically God. And writing about a world in which God is active day by day is really tough. Writing about what's in its head is virtually impossible. Even writing about what it does to us is really, really hard. Most science fiction writers, it seems to me, either ignore that or they cheat. Ian M. Banks cheated magnificently. I think with Star Tide Rising, you essentially ignore it. You don't have much AI in that book.
Well, I do have the NIS machine.
Yeah, but it's not kind of running things, which it should be, really.
No, no. What I do is in the Uplift universe is I show that the machines butted off to do their own civilization, and that they have a major disadvantage in that digital cognizance is detectable, and therefore it can be targeted.
Is it helpful to be able to target something that's much, much smarter than you? I mean, if it targets you back, you're toast.
Well, one of the things that I say in my nonfiction and I hint at in my fiction is that most of the dystopic interpretations of AI have an answer. And I talk about this in my nonfiction, The Transparent Society. And that is, if you are concerned about overwhelming power by a power at the top of a pyramid, take a look at how we solved that when those powers were human. Because almost all human civilizations that had agriculture quickly developed into pyramids of authority and privilege, run by kings and priests and lords. And what we did is we managed to either make those vestigial and symbolic, as you were smart enough to do, or recurring infestations, as we do in America. But nevertheless, there are ways to deal with that. And as Adam Smith said, you get them competing with each other.
I'm not saying that superintelligence is necessarily a dystopian outcome. I don't think it necessarily is. It could be an absolutely wonderful outcome. I think on balance, it probably will be. But whether it's good or bad, and it's probably not in the middle, it's probably either very good or very bad, it's really hard to write about it because it's really hard to envisage what a superintelligence will want to do.
You're completely right. And Ian Banks, of course, he portrays superintelligence as deciding to be benevolent, deciding to occupy that topmost niche, but also giving humanity a lot of really interesting tasks to do. So that if we want to be lotus eaters, we can be, with pat on the head. But if we want to take on challenges at the limit of our abilities, sure. And of course, the notion of hybridization is the one that Ray Kurzweil has been pushing for a long time. And it eases into the theology of Mormonism. Through merit, individual human beings may get augmented and then earn another augmentation and then another augmentation and basically ascend Mount Olympus as some derived version of the human that was born from a woman.
Which seems our best, most plausible future, as long as the machines are happy to merge with us.
Yes, earning the right to be patted on the head as really, really, really cool apes who managed to overcome their proclivities, especially male ones, enough to give birth to gods? Well, all right. I talk about that a fair amount, perhaps a bit less in my novels than in my short fiction. And you're right, a lot of science fiction simply ignores that. One of the best science fiction series of recent years, The Expanse, utterly ignores two things. One is AI, and the other is the fact that if you are accessing that much asteroidal wealth, there's no way that human women could spill into the world enough human beings to be poor. In The Expanse, both of those facts are ignored in order to give us a wonderful, terrific story, and what you have to do is you have to cauterize that part of your brain, or the woman sharing the couch with you watching the TV will murder you.
Well, there's a third thing it ignores, which is the sheer intolerability of living on an asteroid.
David, you've been commenting on matters of interest for many decades now. Your book, The Transparent Society, is 25 years old this year. I wonder if you've changed your mind in recent years about any key points.
Interestingly enough, just 4 weeks ago was the 25th anniversary of Kevin Costner's brilliant release of his movie based upon my novel, The Postman, choosing to release it on exactly the same weekend as Titanic.
That's one of the reasons it didn't do so well in the box office, is it?
People ask me to summarize my opinion of it, and they're very surprised when I say that despite the fact that Costner was a bit of a Hollywood twit toward me, that's not important. What was important is that the moral basis of the book about citizenship, about how the lone hero is not what it's about. The lone hero can help, but civilization is based on large numbers of people remembering that they were once mighty beings called citizens. And that's what the novel The Postman is about. Costner and his screenwriter Brian Helgeland nailed that. The moral center of my book, the heart, is absolutely there in that film, and for that I can forgive anything. Now you add the fact that Costner is a brilliant cinematographer and the flick is one of the dozen most gorgeous musically and visually ever shot. And that the first half of the movie, I thought, was very well written. The last quarter or third was somewhat lobotomized, and that's too bad. If he had talked to me, I might have been able to help. But what you're left with is gorgeous, big-hearted, and dumb. Well, you know, gorgeous, big-hearted, and dumb is what my wife married. And so it's hard for me. Well, in any event, 25 years ago, last month, there was that. And there's talk about, right now, about movie versions of killing people and the Uplift universe and all of that, but the complexity tends to scare producers.
I think they should do Stones of Significance instead. That would be my choice.
Oh, well, Stones of Significance is my short story. It's in my new collection called The Best of David Brin. And that's the one that deals directly with what you were talking about, Callum.
Yep.
Exactly. The relationship of humanity with our becoming gods. And does the story end when we have created essentially Eden on Earth? So I respect that. But you were asking, David, about the Transparent Society, which also is 25 years old. Alas, I have pretensions of being somebody who should be listened to. The CIA and all that, they invite me in, I talk, I blah, 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 I see eyes dilate, and then I don't see the best ideas being dealt with. In the Transparent Society, I talk about how the solution to so many of our problems today happens to be the solution that we've already used, and that is reciprocal accountability. You open things up enough, and we can hold each other accountable, because the fundamental of human nature is that we're delusional. I write product for our ability to delude ourselves with stories. I'm honest about it. I'm saying, here's a delusion for you. This ought to take you half an hour to read, and you'll feel real good afterwards. You'll think about it for a while. But I'm not claiming it's real. We are infested with charlatans who are doing incantations, saying, this chant, repeat this chant, and you'll be convinced that it is an incantation that actually describes the world and explains why you can hate your fellow citizens. And the one thing we found across the last 6,000 years, especially the last 200, has been transparency. You cannot spot your own delusions. Science helps. Science teaches us to say the one great catechism of science, I might be wrong. And we have experimental methods so that scientists learn how to find maybe two-thirds of their own errors. But in the end, the only thing that penetrates all these errors is competition, as Adam Smith said. And you can't have competition-based delusion piercing without transparency. That's really the fundamental.
So you welcome more cameras. You wouldn't ban access to cameras and surveillance. You just say, make sure that everybody can be monitored.
Yes. Well, people get the idea when they read the Transparent Society or when I talk about this. They get the idea that transparency and everybody having the cameras can deal with the first order problem that we face. And that is a return to pyramid of repression. Kings, priests, Big Brother. If everybody can see Big Brother all the time, then we will never get Big Brother. Then you get a secondary problem, and that is the problem of how people will behave with this power. Might you get the horror of the 51% openly and democratically voting to repress minorities and diversity, as you see in Fahrenheit 451. Fahrenheit 451 is not Orwell or Huxley. It's a democracy still. People have the right to vote. It's just that they're voting to repress disruptive thought. How do you deal with that secondary level? You actually think about what those cameras are doing. Because if the people have a value system of diversity, a value system that bullying is the worst thing, then who's going to get caught with all those cameras? Voyeurs, peeping toms, bullies. If the bullies are caught by the cameras, using their cameras to spy in your bedroom and to bully you for your harmless eccentricities, and that is considered socially to be worse than almost anything, then what you have is the solution to the secondary level problem. And that is bullying of diversity, forcing homogeneity, invasions of privacy are bad. And when they're caught, you tell their mom, you tell their mothers. If the cameras are supplemented by that kind of social value, then transparency becomes privacy's friend. You'll be able to say to people who invade your privacy, MYOB, M-Y-O-B, mind your own business, and enforce it. Now, am I saying that this is the solution? How the hell should I know? It's my job to present Gedanken experiments. But it is the solution that we've used up to this point to get more privacy and more freedom than anybody else, any of our ancestors ever had. And it is the solution that may help us to cross the path of AI. And I've been saying this over and over again at all these AI meetings. Everybody wants to do Asimov laws of robotics to keep AIs beneficent.
Well-behaved.
Well-behaved. Look, I channeled Isaac. I wrote Foundation's Triumph with the approval of the Asimov estate, tying together all his loose ends. I understand the laws of robotics. They won't work. But what you can do is what we do now with the powerful, and that is break them up into competing units. When you are attacked by a super intelligent being that's already out there, we have swarms of them out there. When you are attacked by a super intelligent being called a lawyer, an attorney, what do you do?
Well, sometimes you just get screwed.
Yes, but generally speaking, the right thing to do is to hire your own super intelligent, somewhat artificial being called a lawyer. If we give the AIs cell walls, separate senses of identity, and a drive to compete with each other, the possibility exists that if any of them are conspiring to become Skynet, others will detect it and tattle on them. I personally see no other way out, because I'm not going to detect Skynet.
So it sounds like that's part of the solution. It may not be the complete solution to the many challenges of fast-changing technology, but I'm sure it is part of the solution. David, you've given us a great deal of your time. We've ran on, deservedly, longer than we normally have for these episodes. I want to thank you for giving us so much to think about. You've given us lots of book recommendations as well from yourself and from others, so thanks for these. I look forward to coming back and discussing some of this with you perhaps in a year's time.
Well, as the audience does not see, I am giving you guys a couple of thumbs up. I rattle on and on, but your questions were so eliciting, shall we say. So you got me talking.
Well, that's very kind. It's been great to have you on, David.
Best of luck to us all, because all hands need to be on deck to some degree or another.
Absolutely.
All hands on deck. Absolutely. Thank you so much.